It's mostly about internal waves. So a lot of you have been doing like intro to some topic. I'm going to talk about myself because no one really knows what I do. So basically the overview of what I'm going to talk about today is what role internal waves could play in the submesoscale. And the way I approach the problem is kind of like I ask stupid questions. And I'm wondering if people will come up with even more stupid answers. And then you learn something. So I come from a PhD in an experimental group in Grenoble. So a lot of what I do is geared towards the pragmatism you have in the lab. You have to have it in the lab. So I'm a theoretician who sucks at math. And I'm a freshwater oceanographer. I'm in Toronto. It's even worse than a freshwater economist. Most of what I do is about idealized numerical modeling. I started studying wave-wave interactions and lap scale. So I have a weird attraction towards non-hydrostatic phenomena.
What kind of experiments in Grenoble? Was that an oceanographic group or was it a...
It was a GFD group.
Bank experiments?
Yeah, the Coriolis turntable. So I did not do experiments, but I grew up around these people. And a couple years ago, someone in Germany invited me to talk about the role of viscosity in the ocean. And my first reaction was, what? I don't do that. In fact, I looked back at what I do, and viscosity, usually you try to neglect it, and it comes back in an unexpected way. So that's also a theme that gravitates around what I do. So I watched a video. I wasn't there, but I watched a video the first day Baylor drew that picture about the ocean basins. I said, boundary layer, what is the boundary layer? So it was like, anything that happens in there could be the boundary layer. So here could be the submesoscale. For example, you have a lot of latitude. The ocean.
Also at the bottom.
Yeah. I'm getting to that. So the ocean could be boundary layer, the entire ocean. I'm actually focusing on what happens here and what happens there. One of the questions, it's actually linked to what kind of viscosity is effective in the ocean, is what is the spectrum of the ocean? So there's like peaks, tidal peaks, there's a continuum. I'm still wondering what sets this continuum. And
that's the spectrum that leaves out everything except
internal waves. It's all internal waves. That's the F peak. And a lot of what I find is a lot of what happens there sends waves in the interior. And I'll show a few examples of what I do.
These are turbulent boundary layers, yeah?
Yeah. So basically, you know what happens at a large scale, and you know you'd like to cascade everything down to the micro scale. And right now, we're coming from a large scale, we're studying a lot of submesoscales. And I'm actually wondering if there's a life between the submesoscale and what happens, the tiny scales, the viscous, the molecular scales. I'd like to think that there's actually more physics intermediate between these two scales that are worth studying. So maybe a basic, very, very basic intro about internal waves. I'll write them. Vector form. So basically, I work off of the boost. Say again.
Again, focusing on inertial gravity.
Oh yeah. They're everywhere in what I do. So basically, the equations I work off of are some form of Boussinesq equation. So. So including dissipation, forcing. And if you take these equations, and here they're linearized, let me just write the nominated terms to kill them later.
In your momentum equation, is there a buoyancy term?
Yeah. Yeah, to couple the two. And then it's incompressible. It's Boussinesque. And try to linearize these equations, do whatever it takes to kill these terms. You can rewrite all these equations, then you kill the pressure. You can rewrite all these equations in matrix form. This being a 4x4 matrix, so I have made a so the vector contains the buoyancy field as well. Then you plug all this into your equations, you look for the eigenvectors. It's a game you can play if you want to learn how to use the symbolic math software. You get that the eigenvalues of this problem are a determinant is something like this, with this capital omega being the dispersion relation of internal waves, non-hydrostatic. Old habits die hard. And
here you don't separate velocity to the wave field and to the dynamic motions.
To the what motion?
Dynamic motions.
Well, it's
for example, there is a Doppler effect.
Doppler. No, well, you assume.
You don't have a back.
You assume rest.
Like this, yeah.
Yeah, you assume. So I would. This would intervene by terms, by expanding around some mean flow here, which I kill. I assume. Just from I'm just setting a few pictures.
Okay.
Now this m squared divided by this, or k squared divided by this, you could introduce a new variable. So this becomes your dispersion relation. Basically, what this means, what this angle theta, the reason why this angle theta is introduced is, imagine you have an object, the fluid. It's very long. It's very long because we have killed one of the horizontal directions. And you oscillate it, and it'll send waves. At an angle with the vertical, that angle is theta. So pretty sure almost everyone knows this. This is some cool I like to show these videos. Oh, no. So how do you do it? Do it fast or do it slow?
Slow.
Ah. So basically, you have to picture this object in the middle is like a cylinder, and it's oscillating in this direction. So this is in a lab. This is visualized with the Schlieren method. So you oscillate with a certain frequency. It sends waves with certain angles with the horizontal. This angle here is theta. If you oscillate faster, so here there's no rotation. If you oscillate faster, you increase theta. You send steeper beams, and the dispersion relation is bounded. So if you oscillate slightly faster than n in this case, you cannot, the sine squared cannot be higher than 1, and you obtain evanescent waves. So this is, this contains 70% of the physics I really know. And it will come up in unexpected ways. Then the other mode, oh. everything else, so it's behind the screen now, but there was an omega could be equal to 0, that's the geostrophic motion, geostrophic and hydrostatic motion. Anything that's slow can be projected on this. Screw you. No, I can't. Anyway. To set a few pictures.
When the omega is above buoyancy frequency, what do I get?
Sorry, what? You get these evanescent waves. There's just nothing can oscillate this fast in the ocean.
But you still see something, right?
Well, you see the evanescent waves around the object. The higher you oscillate, the closer they'll be to the object, but the fluid around cannot be disturbed. Okay. Maybe you're thinking about the waves you saw at the beginning or the end, but that's the impulse response when you just turn the motor on or off.
Okay, but if you oscillate omega all the time.
Once you're steady, you cannot.
Okay. You saw waves, but they decay exponentially as you move forward.
And you consider homogeneous situations when there was no refraction of waves and all this.
Later.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It will ramp up.
In that case, you have high dissipation around the object, right?
Yeah. You have to. It's a tank, a lab tank. I think the tank was this big.
Yeah.
Nick deals with one when he teaches.
Yeah, we did this experiment. If you write out the dispersion relationship, it might become clear why the modes have to decay.
Because of viscosity?
Well, just cosine theta can't exceed 1.
Yeah. So it's here. The frequency, so these sines and cosines are bounded to be between 0 and 1.
Yeah.
And it turns out if f is less than n, as is the case often in the ocean, then the frequency can only be between f and n.
How are you visualizing the lab experiments? Are just curious.
How that was visualized?
Visualization, how did you see those things?
Well, it wasn't me, but so you just... If you do it the old way, the way I would do it when I was an undergrad, you just light up your fluid and you try to make it, you try to have a collimated beam, and then you filter it, so you pass it through a slit. You block the zero frequency physically by like adding a black dot where the Fourier transform is equal to where you have all your zero modes, then you bring it back into physical space and you have all the fluctuations. So it's the fluctuations are because the light is deflected by the density fluctuations. Basically, you try to just get the fluctuations. You can do it by hand. I remember doing it when I was an undergrad. It's called Schlieren. And then you have this mode. Omega is equal to 0. That's the slow stuff we saw in the video. Those weren't distracted by the music. So it's the geostrophic hydrostatic mode. It's closely related to the Ertel PV. Something like that. Doesn't really. So yeah, that's the Ertel PV I will use. It doesn't really matter which one you use. You can use many different flavors. And this quantity, so if you know this quantity, the standard paradigm is that you can have all the information about the slow flow is contained in this quantity.
Sorry, but why is the NZ here?
That's just a matter of how you define your buoyancy fluctuations.
Yeah, because
they have
different unit, right? They're different
That's an acceleration.
Because
oh.
N square equals B.
Yeah. anyway, so, and this quantity is tightly related to Kelvin circulation theorem. And the game, when you try to see what the effect of the internal waves are on the balanced flow, is how can you mess around with the PV? How can you modify the PV? How can you modify circulation contours? So if you go back to your intro fluids classes, you can modify this by adiabatic stuff, processes, baroclinic processes, which in GFD we take care of by just using contours that flow along isospignals, and what I call direct forcing. If you actually have a force that can create circulation, then you will create circulation. Coriolis force is supposed to be included in that. There are ways to include it in the circulation. That's how we do in GFD. So this is where, so beginning of the week, we heard about GLM. And I think the treatment was tuned for people studying surface waves. There is a few rare people who study GLM, who try to apply GLM to internal wave dynamics. Because in this case, this is really a fundamental thing here. This is saying that, so the two modes are orthogonal, which I forgot to say. So meaning physically that imagine you have a fluid with some vortex induced trophic hydrostatic balance, and then you send waves, you have wave makers on the sides, you send waves, you will deform that vortex, it will flow, it will maybe change shape.
Sorry, could you please write the definition of gamma?
Of gamma? Oh. Yeah. So C being a material contour. Gamma, oh yeah, gamma is a scalar, yeah. So you have your vortex, you draw a contour on an isospignal, then you send waves, you try to disturb that contour. The waves will visibly disturb that contour, but then once they're gone, or it takes a natural shape like one of these shirts that don't wrinkle. Now, so just this simple treatment tells you, oh, you cannot, so internal waves, they just go by, they disturb and they stir, but once they're gone, the problem is the same. So you could just...
You use the word orthogonal? Are you a poet?
Poet? I wish I was. If that makes me one, yeah. Why?
Define your norm.
Oh. Define my norm. So with the simple...
Just to say I'm a poet.
Oh, okay. I have no norm. No, with the simple, actually with the simple 4x4, the simple 4x4 matrix, you can actually like dot product the eigenvectors to each other.
So
just a game.
So in some sense, it's just integral presentation of the generation of vorticity, what you would like to explain here.
What I'm trying to explain is why, if you just stick to the most basic principles, internal waves should not matter. And how to find cases in which they matter. And basically, I'm after cases in which I can disturb these contours.
What is the role of turbulence for generation?
They will be here.
Just here, just, okay.
Yeah.
To relate with Reynolds stress, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. So you have those wave makers disturbing your contour. If they don't dissipate, they just go away. Now, if they dissipate, if they leave something behind, you still have to conserve momentum in particular. So they have to leave something behind that's long-lasting, it'll modify gamma. And what they leave behind could be like breaking and turbulence and then eventually non-conservative processes. So yeah, this is taken care of by choosing your contour. This is taken care of by ignoring forcing and including the porous force in your circulation. So really what you're after is adiabatic processes. So now,
you mean diabatic processes?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, absolutely. So where does, so I mentioned.
And volumicity, if you write equation for volumicity, is just vector product of gradient pressure by gradient of density. Is it correct?
Yeah, but if you draw your contour on an isopycnal, on an isentrope, if you want to be even better, then all these cross products go.
Yeah, okay.
So where was I? So basically, the effect of viscosity and nonlinear effect. So that presentation was linear. It ignored dissipation. The dissipation, the nonlinear effects, they will break that orthogonality. And so we talked about, William talked about GLM. GLM for internal waves, in my opinion, so I did a postdoc with Oliver Bühler, so I'm a bit brainwashed, but is perhaps the formalism that gives you the cleanest idea of how internal waves disturb this this gamma. And then if they actually disturb it in a long-lasting way, then you have a long-lasting effect, you have a permanent effect, and that's like your entry point into understanding how internal waves matter for balanced flow. So GLM, and in particular GLM, so it contains an average form of the circulation. If you're looking for mean motions, but you have an Eulerian grid and you average, say over time, you will have big fluctuations because your isopycnal contours will cross your Z level. So you will get a lot of terms. It'll look like the whatever you're trying to average is fluctuating a lot, but that's not because Lagrangian stuff is changing. It's just because you're measuring different things at different times. So GLM takes care of that by being a Lagrangian. So it's basically a labeling of the particles by their mean position. If that's a little too abstract, think initial position.
You mean Lagrangian?
The Lagrangian stuff is not changing, but you're seeing, if you're averaging over a Z level, you're seeing a lot of changes because you're sampling different isopycnals. So GLM takes care of that. So
excuse me, so how have we generalized? I guess the Lagrangian mean would be if you're following a particle and taking the average.
Yeah.
So what's generalized in this?
Not sure it's general. I've never really understood why it was generalized. I think it's actually a subset.
Better. It's more poetic.
It actually sounds better, but it works, and that's something you see if you actually read the 78 paper, which I got to about 2/3 of it. There's a lot more physical insight. I didn't know these papers by home. I tried to look them. Yeah, the derivations are compact, but they leave the physics out. GLM works because they knew that. So tracking particles in a Lagrangian way can be a mess because the precision can be intertwined. And Baylor was mentioning this only works if you can invert the map, and if it's too convoluted, it's broken down, you cannot do it. They knew that it would work, I think, because they knew that everything pretty much sticks to isopycnals and that you cannot stir your contours too much. So I think this physical intuition they had in 78.
Why is it that you can't stir your contours too much?
You can, But in all the simple problems I've seen GLM apply to, it's the case. You don't stir your contour. Yeah. So GLM is a nice conceptual tool. So what you can do with it is actually fairly limited for internal waves. But it gives you a good, I think it gives a good understanding of what can go on. So, but I was reacting to the generalized. I don't think it's generalized. I actually think it really only works with constraints proper to geophysical flows.
So well, I don't think it's two constraints, but it is generalized. But we don't need to go into that.
Okay. We don't. GLM basically do the mapping William was talking about. X, so from Lorentz positions you switch to positions track Lagrangian tracking positions, to position tracking particle tracking positions. So this is your mean position. This is the fluctuations around it. You do this, you plug this into your Navier-Stokes equation and all that. That's a lot of derivatives. You crank up the chain rules. You end up with tons of terms. Then you average, and if you've chosen your average well, most of these terms go. What you're left is what happens to the mean dynamics with the influences of the waves clearly separated. So you define a GLM, so a generalized Lagrangian mean velocity, which is the average of your velocity on this moving map. This is an average. Now your talent resides in choosing the proper average for what you need to use it for. You can derive, you can define fluctuations. So this is the actual velocity. So there's a mean part and a fluctuation part. It all relies on the fact that if you take the average of the fluctuation part, you get zero. And that's actually not obvious. If you read the 78 paper, there's a series of conditions for which this should work. That's one of them.
So this implies some kind of Reynolds averaging?
Not necessarily.
Any averaging you want.
Yeah. At this point, we're just playing with the equations and doing a lot of algebra.
What makes it unique is you take two average quantities to be zero. One is xi, and the other one is the v little l bar. That's what specifies the path as being unique. Otherwise, you have a multitude of paths. But as I said, it's not obvious. And people pondered over this for decades. Seriously, it's not something you can do over coffee.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the 78 approach is to say, it's true as a postulate. And if it's not, then nothing works. So it's assuming it works. So you do this, and you end up with a set of equations. I'm going to write a set of equations that I use in one of my papers. So for the vorticity, for example,
it's a
this is where we make fun of the substitute teacher.
What is here, D?
Okay, I'm not done. I'm not done defining everything. D is like a GLM material derivative. P, so the expression is would take about this much.
Is it grad of the red U minus P, or is it curl of U minus P?
It's curl, yeah, it's a vorticity. And there is one for buoyancy that would look a lot like the regular buoyancy equation. So what's a bit, so it kind of looks like a normal vorticity equation. You have to replace, here you have to replace velocity by the velocity minus the pseudo momentum. Here you have a divergence. For internal waves, now my understanding, for surface waves, you have to be careful when you want to kill this one. For most of the internal wave problems, you can use your brain on. This one is usually negligible.
It's small for surface waves, actually.
Yeah, so the only way for this theorem to be non-negligible is to have a really jagged field. A lot of derivatives. This term looks familiar. This term looks familiar. And then you have some forcing. So then you have most of what GLM can tell you here.
This is a force, just external force or what?
So it can be a combination of your external forces, but if you have viscosity, diabatic effects, it'll show up in there. So now you have everything. So forget about external forces, forget about dissipative processes. So this guy is zero. We've neglected this one. This quantity shows up, and this quantity, for example, now you have to imagine a little thought experiment. You have a stratified fluid rotating with an isopycnal at rest. And then you send waves from below and they propagate up. The pseudo momentum is a wave quantity. Again, I'm not going to write the definition. William did it on Monday for his case. But it only involves fluctuations, average effect of fluctuations. So you start, so imagine, so you have your isopycnal at rest. There's no average velocity. And then you start wave from below. At first, you have no wave, so you have no pseudo momentum. Then your wave packet propagates up. What happens is, if your wave packet is not a plane wave, so it's a, your wave packet is a wave packet, so it's, in terms of plane waves, a collection of an infinite number of plane waves, nonlinear effect. They will slightly interact with them, with each other, and some of these interactions will land on the zero frequency band. This will create a mean flow. This has to stay constant. This will create a mean flow that will accommodate the passage of this wave. Then the waves go, mean flow goes back to zero. This is related to the conservation of PV. Mean flow, it's not because it's a mean flow. Well, that's potential vorticity.
Sorry, you are talking about a linear wave, right?
I'm talking about a weakly nonlinear wave packet.
Even by wave itself?
Sorry, what?
I mean, all the waves that has to be have a nonlinearity for this to work.
Yeah, yeah. So if it's a wave packet, it's a collection, it's an infinite number of plane waves that form a wave packet. Imagine taking a Fourier transform of it. Nonlinear effects, necessarily you will have interactions between all these plane waves.
But here, velocity is just only a wave field, yeah?
In my thought experiment.
You don't separate to the fluid velocity and the wave velocity. It's just total velocity.
So to understand what I'm saying, and you don't have to agree that it's a good setup, but everything is weak. You have mean vortices, and they're weak, and the waves are weak. And they interact in an even weaker manner. That's just to keep everything clean.
Mm-hmm. I think there is a separation, because there's the U, R, L. So that's like the fluid velocity. And then there's also waves on top of that,
yes,
which are averaged out. And those, the correlations between those small fluctuations are what gives you the pseudo moment.
But these fluctuations of fluid velocity or the fluctuations of wave field?
It's the fluctuations of the wave field.
Okay.
That's fluctuations of the wave.
Wave is velocity.
Yeah.
Formally.
Yeah, this is wave.
It's actually very difficult to separate them. That's why you use GLM, because it separates
okay.
them precisely.
Okay. Because physically they're separated because wave field satisfies to the special relation for the waves and so on and so on. But
yeah.
Right, they talk to one another.
Yeah, that's okay. The way they talk to one another.
And
okay.
And so you're basically just showing
because you can wave in the right direction
waves, right?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Says that if you're removing the original wave field, you have to draw a slow response.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you remove the pseudo-momentum from the wave,
so
what do you mean by that?
So the moment circulation theorem associated with the equation you wrote down says
mm-hmm.
something like the evolution of V minus P
yeah.
has got to be equal to something. So if you think about removing pseudo-momentum from your wave field, it's going to be that mean flow response.
Yeah, so...
on the right-hand side is zero.
So now, and again, there's nothing trivial about all this, but the fact that this vorticity equation exists and is very close to the one we know means you can do the same steps. And I'm ignoring rotation. I'm ignoring F right now. You can do the same steps and find a Kelvin circulation theorem. And that's really the effect of the mean wave. So you have your contour. It's on your isotopic null. Initially, it's at rest, so initially you have no waves and no mean flow. Waves go through. You drive a mean flow. Your thing starts to circulate. Waves leave, and your circulation is gone. That's if waves don't dissipate. So a few more steps that I'm skipping. But you can derive a GLM PV based on this. And I'm going to ignore rotation for now. GLM. This tells you that if you start with zero PV, because if you just reason in terms of a layer and you have waves and then there's a mean flow has to be PV, so how does that work? Here it tells you that if you start with zero PV, your waves can drive a mean flow.
What is a PD?
PV, potential vorticity.
Ah, potential vorticity, okay.
Yeah, which is supposed to be conserved if all the sources I was mentioning before are also absent. So and if they're not, then you start forcing your PV. So I think, my personal opinion, this really gives you the most basic effect you can have of waves. This is a nonlinear quantity, so all these internal waves interacting with each other nonlinearly can have a pseudo-momentum that drive a mean flow. Then, if you add dissipative effects, then that change in the mean flow can be made permanent. So the Buller and McIntyre 2005 talks a lot about writes these notions in conservative form. So they define an impulse simple for now. So we define this. So that's called the impulse. Imagine you have a vortex dipole.
Is there a curl? Or a curl?
No. It is kind of a curl, if you think about it.
Oh, Q is a scalar.
Q is a scalar, yeah. Right. We're not talking about this. So if you have a vortex dipole, the impulse would be a vector going in this direction. It's kind of, the dipole will move. So this quantity, that's what this quantity means, say for a vortex.
This is a large-scale structure? You discuss now or no?
This vector is an integrated. Yeah. It's integrated over the volume. I'll get to it in a second. Now you define pH, the horizontal component of your pseudo-momentum. They have, these two quantities have, we're not, so no dissipation for now. These two quantities have well-defined, I mean, this tensor is actually a mess. It's a very long, there's a lot of terms. But whatever it is, so it varies. There's time variations, there are fluxes going in and out. But the source terms exactly cancel each other.
So
nothing else.
Right, this sum is conserved.
Yeah.
I plus pH. Yeah?
Yeah. So now if you add them.
Yes.
And choose an integration domain that's far enough that you don't have any fluxes at the boundaries. Then you.
This is without dissipation. Yeah.
Without dissipation, yeah.
How is this different than Kelvin's wrench from classical fluid mechanics, which tells us the impulse we need to apply to a fluid to get a prescribed velocity field? That's, of course, only unique if things are suitably well behaved at infinity. It's the same concept, right? It's the same thing. Okay.
There's nothing really, in terms of physics, it doesn't give you access to new physics. It just gives you a way to track.
Well, the impulse is important, right? Because you get rid of those diverging surface terms in the momentum integral that makes a lot of things well formed that aren't classically for incompressible fluids. So there is information in the impulse.
Yeah. What I'm saying is, Brulé McIntyre in 2005, I don't think they discovered anything new.
Okay.
They just describe phenomena with this formalism in a way that makes it easier to track what the effect of the waves is, what happens to the PV.
This conservation law is related to some symmetries or not?
Same symmetries.
Oh, if it's general, it should be related. There's a symmetries.
There's the same symmetry as the PV relies on.
Wow.
I mean, they're all derived from conservation laws related to vorticity. You can always invoke the particle relabeling symmetry.
That's
relation of 3D. It's a bit busy. 10 days. So, over derived all the conservation laws under certain conditions, for instance, free surface flow, using the algebras, and just looked at the symmetries of the Garmin equations, and from that, you can get this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are symmetries corresponding to these.
Eventually, you probably will land on the particle relabeling symmetry.
Well, for vorticity conservation, for sure.
But this is all. Yeah.
But you get impulse and things like this too out of those. That exists somewhere.
Anyway. So. So this conservation law, guys.
Come on, children, pay attention.
And then with dissipation, what happens is you send your waves, you let them interact with your balance dynamics. If your waves dissipate, that's also a series of calculations that are in Buller and McIntyre. You dissipate pseudo-momentum, you turn it into impulse. It's like, so the whatever mean flow the wave is creating when passing through your isotope, it will get sort of frozen onto the PV. With dissipation, there's a bit, no, that.
Without dissipation, just go back.
Yeah, without dissipation, yes. Go back and forth. This is what this conservation law tells you.
So in some sense, you neglected interaction between waves and fluid flow.
No. That's the whole point. That's the whole point of this. They're talking to one another.
If this thing is conserved, then this is how your waves create or interact with their mean flow. And then with the dissipation, you can derive analytic expressions that tell you exactly how much mean flow you're forcing when you dissipate. Now, the range of problems you can actually solve by hand with GLM is actually fairly small. I happen to have published one a few years ago, just as an illustration.
So I have a question about these equations. So you said everything's derived without dissipation. And then afterwards you invoke dissipation.
You're still using
those equations, right? By saying that, well, start off with some pseudo momentum and then you dissipate it all away, then you have to be left with impulse.
Yeah. Okay. This is why actually using dissipation is probably not a good. It's probably not a good idea. Dissipation.
But it's kind of like topologically changing a fluid, which you can do in classical mechanics too. You can put vorticity into and out of the fluid by just saying at some point you change the topology of the flow, and that's like kind of it's like a way to parameterize the removal of the wave to momentum, and just say it has to go into the mean somehow. And that's, I think, a way we think of it on the surface.
Maybe.
That's how I think about it on the surface, but.
Yeah. If you read the papers and details, these notions are floating around. I'm trying to stick to make the connection between the equations and like how you can think of these things physically. But basically, yeah, the idea of the pseudo-momentum, it's like a distillation process. You know the waves have nonlinear effects, and it can be a blur about what kind of nonlinear effects force PV and in which case. The pseudo-momentum isolates all that. It's like filtering all the nonlinear effects that are created by interacting nonlinear waves and really zeroing in on those that will communicate with the balance flow. And GLM, now there are different ways to say what I said with different formalisms. I find GLM kind of clear once you understand what the notions are about what it is. So there was a paper, now it's 2012, so a few years ago now, that was with Oliver Buehler. We were just studying the flow around a small bump. It was tidal flow, so perfectly periodic. It was a top lid, and it was tidal flow, so periodic, but also in 3D, the tide usually rotates. So we had this basic setup, constant N, constant F. I'm just going to skip to the results. So you have to solve two problems here, because it was all done pen and paper, plotting with a computer. You need to understand what is the internal tide that is radiated from the mountain. We did that with Green's functions. So basically point sources at the bottom. So here's your mountain, here's your rectilinear tide. Tide flows over the bump. From the side, you get the beams I was talking about, I was showing in the lab early on. So that's from the side. Now, if you look at it from the top, you have maximum radiation in the direction of the tide, no radiation perpendicular to the tide, and continuous evolution. So that's your wave field, and then we add a little bit of dissipation in the equations. And we could, assuming everything was weak, that's the thing, GLM works, it's supposed to work at all orders, but really practically I've never seen a finite.
You're not using constant buoyancy frequency?
Constant buoyancy frequency.
Beams seems...
Well, they're kind of wide and they interact, but they go straight. The characteristics are straight. So we solved for the wave field, and then with a little bit of the dissipation operator, you can compute all the terms analytically. This is what happens. So this is still your mountain. This is the direction of the tide. The arrows are the force you're applying on the balanced flow. So you're pushing away from the mountain in the direction of maximum radiation, not at all in this direction. And if you curl it, you get the forcing of PV, and you get these. So it's like two dipoles back to back with the waves being radiated outward. Then we had some fun with it. So more general tide, something that rotates with a principal axis and a minor axis. So you get, it's basically the same pattern I've just showed, but quarter phase rotating. So what happens to the forcing of the mean flow? It's nonlinear forcing. So you get, it's like you would get, whoop, can't go back. You would get one quadrupole like this, then one quadrupole 90 degrees, but then it's nonlinear response, so they have to interact with each other. And the response is actually, in this case, axisymmetric, azimuthally symmetric. So you have a trace of the original symmetry of the tide here, but mostly it's this cowboy hat kind of response, creating a vortex right on top of the mountain. And then if you make your mountain wide, kind of like a supercritical kind of flat top mountain, Griot, there's a lot of that in the ocean. These are radiation points, so you send waves here, you send waves here, here, here. There'll be a focal point here. And here you're creating this vortex on top. So that's a structure that's often observed in the oceans. Back in the days that probably wasn't born, DONR was obsessed about fibrillating Griot, so they had a lot of data. And they would see this, and Eric Kunze was published a paper about like what forces this vortex, and he couldn't close it. I saw him in December, and I was like, oh, well, do you want to look into it? And he just went, well, no one's going to fund me for that.
That's right.
But in the 80s, he would have been funded.
Can I ask a very quick question?
Yeah.
So maybe this is a little bit what Daniel's getting at, but with these mean flows, they're independent of the dissipation operator, the form of the dissipation operator you put in?
Yeah, they are. They are very dependent.
The
geometric pattern, you probably wouldn't see a difference, but in terms of like the naked eye, but the intensity and the intensity, maybe the second order, like different spreads, you would get,
you'd see a difference.
You would see a difference. Yeah. So they are, it is dependent. So this wasn't my first. This is the tank I was talking about. This wasn't my first encounter with wave mean flow interactions. So this is, you have to admit, this is a tank. This is 4 meters long. The tank itself is 13 meters diameter. So that was in 2009. So there's a sheet of laser. It's illuminating neutrally buoyant particles. Stratified fluid, of course. And there is a slope here, which you cannot really tell, but I can tell you it's here.
This is like a particle tracking.
Yeah, we'll do PIV on it.
PIV?
Yeah, we'll do PIV on. So there's cameras on the side looking at this sheet of laser sheet. Mm-hmm. And that's another illustration. So the wave generator is here. So what you're going to see is a bunch of plates oscillating, sliding onto each other, mimicking the motion of internal wave with the phase propagating up. And you will see these beams of internal waves. So with trained eye, you see them easily, but it's okay. So the generator is on. So you, focus on here, you should see oscillating motions that characteristic of internal waves. So shearing, phase propagating up. It's going to hit the slope. So that was during my PhD. I was really focusing on wave-wave interactions. So I was hoping to see nonlinear interactions, triad interactions between the incident and the reflected wave. And what happened was completely different. So here you see there's left and right motion pretty much in equal measures. Here everything seems to be moving towards the right. So that was actually, and this is what's going on. This pretty much the same as my mountain. Now, instead of having two waves radiating back to back, you just have one wave hitting the slope. So the generator is here. So you have to pardon my French, but
It should be a three-dimensional picture. Yeah.
Sorry.
It should be a three-dimensional picture.
Yeah. Right. Now we didn't really expect to see it, so we were not set up to do this. But basically, you have. Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing you're talking about. It's three-dimensional. So we saw, this is an average of the velocity over like a couple periods. So you see this mean flow, flowing towards the right. In 3D, you would see something like this, a dipole. And this is, I find this kind of cute. This is time of the day. So and in blue, that's when I was turning the generator on, and that's the phase average kinetic energy in that sheet. And every time it's on. You see the kinetic energy increase. Now, when the motor is off, the camera was off too. But it's hard to believe that it would keep increasing and then fall back right here. And then, every time the generator was on, you could see this mean flow being accelerated.
We tried to see in two perpendicular planes.
No.
No.
The lab is hard. It's wet. Stratified flow is very fragile. You can't. So, you come up with an idea of what you want to measure, but once the stuff is in the water, creating a horizontal laser sheet would be a hole. You'd have to empty the tank, and I don't even know how you do it.
In terms of practically, those things that were oscillating close to the wave generator, how exactly was it? How does it work? What does the wave generator do exactly? You showed these things that were very close to the generator that were going in two directions. So is that what you're generating? Or?
I'm generating internal waves. The generator is here, sending waves.
These dots are what?
They're like plastic particles. Follow the flow.
Okay. And how do you then define the mean flow?
Oh, here I would just average over a couple wave times.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know the period.
So you average over a number of snapshots, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, we have enough
time. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was for GLM. I think it's very useful when you want to think of it as, like when you want to know effect of internal waves on balanced flows, it dissects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This formalism is applied or pure Boussinesq, or it works also for unelastic approximation?
No. There's no limitation.
Limitations?
These on and off conditions have to be met. But then you could use it for acoustic waves. You could use it for surface waves. I'm sure you can use it for inelastic equations too.
Because if you have an inelastic approximation.
Yeah.
Which implies that divergence rho u equals zero, you will have additional terms in the equations.
Yeah, so they are there.
Okay.
So the topography played was that it generated the wave-wave interaction that you were looking for, and that's why you got the UP. I'm just trying to make sure I got the formula.
Yeah, we made a mistake. We were looking for, so here was our slope. We had an incident beam. We would have had a reflected beam. And then some triad interactions in there. I was trying to shift the frequency and hit the resonance frequencies to see 2 omega, 3 omega. So the platform was about to be destroyed. And we had 2 months with money, so just tried something.
What you saw instead was this mean flow?
The mean flow, yeah. We should have confined our flow.
Right. So just to make sure I understand your point, so the mean flow got generated because there was an interaction between the wave packets there.
Because the waves were dissipated.
And
Here, being focused, they were dissipating even faster. So that would push
the
mean flow.
So it was the dissipation of the waves that in the net generated the mean flow, not the wave-wave interaction.
The wave-wave interaction imparted mean flow.
But here is
the dissipation, imprints it on the bounce flow.
All right. So rather than disappearing, what the dissipation did was make it sort of quasi-permanent.
Yeah. This thing propagates like a wave. It could, without dissipation, it could leave.
Okay.
If you make it disappear, then you are left with some mean flow. Now,
so
back.
It's like the effectively, it's like the non-acceleration.
Yeah, it's just these concepts have been.
More general version.
It's a more precise version.
Okay.
It's exactly what happens. But these concepts were invented by everything by Andrews and McIntyre within 2 years. So they're all closely together. So. Yeah?
For to derive this I plus pH equal constant, you need an implicit flow or not?
Yes.
Otherwise,
you need an implicit flow.
Otherwise, it just decays.
Yeah, so in my lab experiment, you would see the waves actually reflect and go, and no mean flow being generated. So that's invisible. The conservation laws, they're interesting where they're fulfilled, and they're also interesting when they're broken. Because then, if you can tell how you break them, how you create circulation,
so
then
what
you...
what determines the scale of these dipoles?
The scale of the, so at first order, it's the scale of the wave packet. Then once it has been imprinted on a PV, it does its own thing. But the forcing is where the wave is, because the forcing comes from the pseudo-momentum. The vertical curl of the pseudo-momentum.
And the forcing for creation of what?
Of the mean flow.
Of the mean flow. Okay.
Then you dissipate the pseudo-momentum, you're left with the mean flow. If you don't dissipate it, it goes, it takes its pseudo-momentum with it, and it leaves the domain. Okay, so if you recall, this quantity impulse, if you integrate it over the volume, it will be biggest when you have a lot of PV and when you integrate over a big volume. So the mesoscale in the ocean, so the mesoscale is basically a lot of impulse and not much pseudo-momentum. So these interactions, and they can describe what happens. Say the internal tide, it gets deflected a little bit by the balance flow, but the balance flow couldn't care less about a pseudo-momentum because it's such a small thing. It's like a reservoir of impulse, and then you have some internal waves trying to move around in it. Now the sub-mesoscale, everyone talks about low PV structures. Oops. Thinking about what could happen to the internal tide near the coast, much smaller scales, the curls are much more important. Now we could be talking about a lot of small, kind of weak PV structures with strongly curled internal tides, for example. You could see these interactions being more important. So that's why I got into it, basically. I saw this picture and I was like, oh, that's a good idea. That could be a good idea. This is why it didn't matter at the mesoscale, but why it could matter at the submesoscale. Now, all these laws, this have been derived in the weak amplitude limit and wherever ray tracing is a good approximation.
Weak amplitude.
Small amplitude.
Yeah? So it means that you took into account three waves interactions and neglect higher interactions?
Three-wave interactions? Like this, you mean?
Three-wave interactions.
Well, that's like 1,000 million.
Mean.
Just wavelength, okay.
Yeah.
The stiffness and skills are often occurring in regions which have high mixing,
yeah,
high dissipation compared to bears. This construct you mentioned is particularly good in sort of weak dissipation. You do want to introduce diverticity to sort of slowly kill it so that it leaves something behind.
Or fastly kill it. Slowly or fastly.
People start to like words now.
that's the problem. So you can extrapolate this picture to do something that's going to say, oh, it's going to matter, except that all these laws are valid when ray tracing applies, which is not in the Samaya scale, where so small amplitude, which is not necessarily in the Samaya scale. I'm thinking about coasts, typically like high mode internal tides in your coast. It can be like a guiding principle as in which direction you should go to and why it could matter, but then I don't expect these laws to apply. But there's still some truth to it. So that is, I will do about half of what I wanted to talk about.
Give a second talk.
Give three.
No.
So, keeping that in mind.
If somebody applied this for atmospheric internal gravity waves?
It was designed, people who designed it had the atmosphere in mind, okay. The average being zonal. Having this in mind, so that's the problem with these interactions that I just erased is what you do next analytically. And I don't think there is any good candidate. Like the scale separation is starting to disappear. Everything that makes analytical calculations possible is starting to disappear at the Samaya scale. So there's no real, in terms of analytical theory, there's analytical formulas. I don't think, not that I know of, I don't think there is a good replacement for GLM or whatever is your favorite formalism. So then you're left with pragmatism. You try to do pragmatic numerical experiments, process studies in the ocean. Trying to...
General pragmatism.
Yeah, generalized pragmatism. trying to extrapolate what you've learned when you could control everything to whatever you're observing in the ocean. So I could think of two ways to be pragmatic. You could be like Sullivan and McWilliams. I don't want to paraphrase, but the tendency these is to take things holistically. Just dump everything into an LES and see what happens. Or you can do like me, dumb, simple experiments. Which brings me to another. So then after a postdoc with Oliver, I kept studying these wave-meaningful interactions.
Once you illustrate, I will defend the dumbness and simplicity of Sullivan, of course.
Oh, no, I'm the dumb one.
Give me the standard and I'll tell you how it's the same.
Okay. You wanted it. So let's forget about dissipation and forcing for now. So here I'm writing the linear Boussinesq equation for a 2D front. M squared being like the horizontal n squared. 2D front, no structure, Jim's favorite setup. So no, the front is infinitely wide. Then you have, hydrostatic, and then you have one less. So these equations, you assume that your geostrophic flow is the big one. It's not going to change. You expand all the fluctuations. You fluctuate around this mean geostrophic front. And so this is by thermal wind balance. So this is actually an expansion of the fluctuations around the thermal wind shear. So you have a jet. You're in a front. You have a jet. We are here, right in the middle of the front. This is the velocity profile. So the density is changing across. These set of equations are like, what if anything that happens here could be considered so small, you could ignore the boundaries? Is that stupid enough, or?
You're winning.
If I had 3 hours, I would talk about how to include those, but I won't have those 3 hours. And you redo the first thing I did with the eigenmodes and the eigenfrequencies and whatever, and you find a new dispersion relation for the your new dispersion relation for small fluctuations evolving in this front has now a coupling between the horizontal and vertical directions. So before, flat isopignals move the object up and down. You have this St. Andrew's cross kind of pattern. In this new system, isopignals are sloped. So that sort of tilts your perspective. There's also the thermal wind shear. I don't want to mess up the sign, so I'm not going to write it. Thermal wind shear also, so it's it goes faster here than here. That's a horizontal vorticity that kind of acts like horizontal Coriolis. So that also tilts your perspective in non-trivial ways. And the angles of propagation are now, they're not symmetric anymore. There is a steep characteristic. There's a steep angle of propagation and a shallow angle of propagation.
What is the reason for the last term in the equation for the omega squared?
It comes from here and here. You have to redo the same operations you did to obtain the initial one. Mm-hmm. It's the same.
Your background stratification is tilted.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And your rotation vector is also slightly tilted.
The gradient of B is not tilted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, so there's a shallow and a steep one, and there are configurations like these, and for different frequencies. There are configurations in a different color. Like these, with the horizontal direction being like this. This is what you would find if you try to plot these angles. And in between, there has to be a configuration with one direction that has an angle with the horizontal, and one direction that's perfectly horizontal. If you just have to tune the frequency, say start from the minimum frequency, and you increase it, you will see these angles change. And at some point, you go through a frequency with a flat characteristic. And it turns out, you can do it by eye, if you replace omega by f, put this one on this side, so that's 1 minus cos squared times f squared, that's sine squared, then you can put this one on this side. Not sure the TV can see it, but the camera can see it. You arrive at this equation, and you do have a solution in which theta is equal to 0. If theta is equal to 0 here and here, then both sides are equal. So the frequency for which you get a flat one. It's a Coriolis frequency, which is good because it happens a lot in the ocean. Things happen oscillating at a Coriolis frequency. And what else is flat in the ocean compared to isopycnal slopes? It's the ocean slope, which means that the textbook internal waves picture of waves reflecting against the slope applies here.
Equal F, just usually natural waves. Is
yeah.
Correct? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so open a good textbook. You will have the three cases of reflection. Reflections against the slope of internal waves. So I'm not in the front anymore, I'm in the lab. Here you have a wall, like the wall I had in my lab experiment. You have this case where it's focusing because the angle with the horizontal has to be conserved. Then you increase your frequency. You cannot reflect into the wall, so you reflect back. And then there's an angle when your wave angle is equal to the wave slope where you send your waves, so stuck to the critical slope, to what's called the critical slope. Nothing can get off of this slope. So here you have the same. You have the same deal, except you have to rotate a lot your head. Now, the wall is horizontal, it's the ocean slope. There are cases for omega less than F. Yeah. You have this, no, omega more than F, waves could reflect against the surface, continue on. Omega less than F, which is actually possible in the front, you can have waves reflecting backward. And for omega equal F, you have a critical reflection. So then we published a couple of papers around it because it turns out when you plug this into, so the plan was, well, let's do three numerical simulations. Oh, I did it again. Now that's adiabatic. So we just created the simplest numerical experiments we could think of. So we're using Jim's favorite setup in front that's infinitely wide. And then you have a wave maker in the middle of your domain, you send waves. So here your wave maker is here, the ocean surface is here. So you see waves, they propagate up, they hit the surface, nothing propagates back down. So you have very intensified conservation of energy. You have a very intensified flow field right below the surface. You have a boundary layer, and nothing propagates.
These are approximately inertial frequency?
So the waves I'm sending right now are exactly inertial frequency. I mean, I have plenty of movies with, like, that's an example with a frequency that's over F, so you send waves from below. So this is the whole pattern. It's just an interference pattern. Send waves from below, they hit the surface. If you filter only upward and downward, you have the incident wave and the downgoing wave. And these lines are the angles predicted by whatever is behind the screen. In the papers, now it's a bit of an advertisement, but we discussed a lot of nonlinear effects. That's a linear simulation where you switched off all nonlinear terms. That's a nonlinear simulation Here you have an interference pattern. Your wave maker is somewhere here. Sine waves up. Here's your interference pattern. And then these are the reflected waves. This is with nonlinearity switched on, and it's actually weakly nonlinear. They're not close to breaking at all. They're really weak. You get higher frequency waves. You get flows that are close to horizontal, actually. So this is for a wave. So these three panels are linear, nonlinear, backward reflecting, critical reflecting, forward reflecting. So backward. Backward is this configuration. Forward is this configuration. So that's low frequency, inertial frequency, super inertial, high frequency. And a thing we discuss a lot is for backward reflection, linear and nonlinear, the response is basically linear. For forward reflection, you get a lot of stuff that you would call turbulence if your domain was 2D. This stuff is, it's very horizontal. It's always nothing, it's not supposed to be, but because the isopignals are sloped, the only symmetry that gives you something horizontal is the ocean surface. So there's something going on here that I'm trying to understand. And
so what do you mean by stable? If it's stable, it's not turbulence.
What's stable?
Said extremely stable.
Oh well, it stays. What it's not stable. Nah. It stays horizontal. It's this the noise you see, the noise you see towards the top. And one thing I try to add a third dimension actually, and it remains along the front, no matter how hard I push it.
In the last case. Effective Reynolds number for waves is much larger than the previous case if you calculate this.
No, they're all the same. I try to keep them the same.
All the same?
Yeah.
So here you have turbulence in the last case. In
the last case,
you don't have turbulence at all.
Yeah, there's a cute explanation, which is cool because I don't have time to switch on to my next thing. There's a paper by Jang and Marcus, Phil Marcus, from 2009. And it's something I was trying to zero in on in my lab experiment back in 2009. If you have forward propagating waves, group speed is like this, k vector is like this. Here, group speed like this, k vector has this kind of orientation. If you add them together, you get a k vector that is more horizontal. That means a group speed, if it was an internal wave, a group speed that would be more vertical. Now, when you do this triad interaction kind of thinking, you also add the frequencies. So you have something that propagates more vertically, with a frequency that's higher, so a signal that would also like to propagate more vertically. So you're kind of close, you can get close to a resonance in this case. But in the other case, it's completely opposite. The signal that's created wants to propagate more horizontally with a higher frequency, and that's too far from resonance. So here you're muting all the triad interactions. And here you're enabling one, and once you enable one, you enable two, three, four, and you get something that's more interesting. And teaser for my next three talks. I was actually almost done. I just needed 20 minutes. okay. I wanted to be at this point. No, I wanted to be at this point 20 minutes ago. So the next thing I tried was. And this is the part where I'm asking for help, basically. So Baylor, when he told me, what I asked him what I should talk about, he said, whatever you're interested in. And that way we can you can find collaborators. So as this talk goes on, I'm talking about things that I understand less and less so that people can help me. So I tried to be a little, so I saw the limitations of the infinite front problem, and I was trying to do something else with just a front. So your isospinals bend, that's your front. So you have the cold side of your front, here it's warm, here it's cold, with a front that would, the structure that would decay with depth. So your isospinals become more and more horizontal as you go down. And do I have time to show a few things? And so it's a significant departure from basically everything we, for example, the parameterization Scott was talking about last week was based on a front. Instead of having a horizontal and vertical structure, was just infinitely wide, like my previous problem. Okay, I got it this time. And it's So that's my front. So okay, you can't really see it, but these colors are density. So your isospinals bend down. These white contours are Richardson number. So there's a jet. Richardson number is associated with a jet. These colors are the jet, the velocity. These contours, these white contours, are Rossby numbers. So now we have Richardson number because there's a vertical gradient. We have a vorticity Rossby number because there's a lateral gradient. And if you blend them together, you get a potential vorticity structure that can be negative, and then you get the symmetric or inertial instability of Scott was talking about. And quick teaser, what am I choosing to tease about? This is an example of the instability Scott was talking about, the symmetric instability. And
2D or 3D?
2D. So not quite there yet. But I'm adding dimensions one by one. So what you see a lot of internal waves radiated. So I've started to talk with to Scott about this. And you see a lot of this isospinal displacements that are not present in the theories Scott's parameterization was based on last week. Basically, the instability Scott was talking about only extract kinetic energy, only creates flows that flow along isospinals. If you had a box, if your region of instability is finite, you need to bring in density from the sides that disturbs the potential energy budget a lot. And yeah, that's so the paper just got accepted. I was hoping to talk more about it, but that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's thank you. And secondly, with some seriousness, the organizers, and if you want to talk again, you know.
Sure.
Sounds like we're getting.
Yeah.